Fine, so I want to continue now with Noach, which we ended with last week, and then we'll move on to the next story after that. But I want to finish up a little bit about Noach first. Last week, we had gotten to the point explaining who Noach was. So we discussed Noach's birth. His birth was unique. Even at birth, they seemed to see something special in him. His name suggests that he would bring some sort of comfort to the world. We spoke about how he was the first one born after the death of Adam, so they saw him as a sign of blessing, because now the curse of Adam may now take a back seat, and we can now move on from that. So that was Noah's birth. Hashem, though, at this point was very upset with the world. We discussed last week all the different sins that the world had done, and why they deserved to be destroyed. And the last pasuk in Parshas Bereishis says, Noach matzachem in Hashem, that Noach found grace in Hashem's eyes. So Noach is this one man left who can find grace in God's eyes. Everybody else was slated for destruction. The Torah continues now. So I want to discuss Noach a little bit more. The person Noach. The Torah continues the first pasuk in Parshas Noach, page 31. These are the offspring of Noach. Noach was a righteous man, perfect in his generations. Noach walked with God. So we do get an introduction to Noach past his birth. And besides the fact he found grace in God's eyes, we get some descriptions here. He was a righteous man. He was tamim. He was perfect in his generation. And Noach walked with God. So these are pretty, very positive descriptions of Noach. He seems to be a very righteous person, a very committed person. And the Torah praises him. And it's an amazing thing. He was now, at this point, 600 years old. Not a young man anymore. And when this occurred, he spent 600 years in a generation, in a world of people who were corrupt, sinners, immoral, dishonest, etc. And Noach was able to maintain his values and maintain his righteousness despite all of that. So it's interesting. There is criticism given of Noach by the rabbis in terms of was he as perfect as we think he was. But bottom line, the fact he was able to hold his own in this type of environment, that itself deserves the title tzaddik, that he's praised for such, and in world depravity, he's able to remain strong. That's an amazing thing. He was kind of a loner in terms of that, because as we see, he's the only one saved. Nobody else was able to reach his righteousness. Nobody else was able to maintain their own self-control and their own values in that environment. So that's Noach. So the it says here, though, he's perfect in his generation. And very famously, Rashi points out here, why does it say he's perfect in his generation? So Rashi tells us, there's a very famous comment of Rashi, he tells us, well, this can be looked at as a positive or as a negative. Some say the fact we emphasize his generation was a positive, meaning despite his generation, despite how bad they were, he was still a tzaddik. And some say, no, it's looking at Noach in a negative sense, meaning we're saying that Noach and his generation was great, but that was all relative to everyone else who were terrible, corrupt, dishonest people. Had Noach been in the generation with Avram Avinu, he would have been a nothing. Right? You can look at that from two perspectives. Are you looking at Noach's relative greatness? Are you looking at Noach in terms of his own, in terms of who he was and how great he could have been? I mean, it could be, had he been placed in a generation of people who are righteous, he'd be even more righteous, because he wouldn't have these negative influences tugging away at him. Or it could be that he would have been the same that he was right now, and in relation to others around, he wouldn't have been as good. So two ways to look at Noach and his righteousness. Bottom line, he was righteous. That we're not debating. But the question is, if we were to compare relative to Abraham, where would he fall in terms of righteousness? Now, why do we bother comparing anyways? I mean, it seems kind of, I don't know, maybe a little, I don't want to say rude, but a little bit out of line to have to really compare Noach's righteousness and figure out, was he as righteous, not as righteous, was he as good as we think he was? Like, why are we beating him up like that? And I think the answer is, because Noach and Abraham do have to be compared. Because Abraham was the one who was chosen by Hashem to begin the Jewish people, and Noach wasn't. So we want to understand that difference. Why was the Noach, as great as he was not the one to be the father of the Jewish people, and Abraham was. So we do learn a lesson from these comparisons, because we see what it takes to be a Jew. What does it take to be the father of Klal Yisrael? Noach did not merit that, and Abraham did. So when you compare the two of them, and you look at their traits, you're trying to not disparage Noach, but you're trying to see the virtues of Abraham and to why he was chosen versus anybody else. That's what I would suggest. So it's important to look at Noach as a tzaddik, as the Torah describes him. The fact that we do have some criticism, or we do sometimes compare, it's not, not to put down Noach, but it's for us to understand the greatness of Abraham. And from that, we can understand what makes us, what Jews are supposed to strive towards, which is Abraham's midos, not Noach's midos. But ultimately, it does say that Noach was righteous, he was perfect in his generation, and he walked with God. And he was somebody that was fit to carry on the mission of Hashem in the world. And Hashem said, I have a mission for man, for mankind. The people who are living right now are not fulfilling that mission. These people are not worth it. They have no potential. They're not getting anywhere. I'm going to kill them. But I have to find one person that could carry on my mission to the world, and that person was Noach. So Noach deserved that. No matter what you say about him, he deserved that. Now this phrase that says he walked with God, so that phrase is an interesting phrase. That phrase is used in various contexts with others as well. It said this before in Bereshis about Chanoch. It says the Chanoch walked with God. We have a similar phrase said with Abraham, that Abraham walked before God. I mean, you have different people who walked with or before. This phrase is used throughout the Chumash. So the question is, what does it mean to walk with God exactly? Like, what does that phrase imply? So the Rabbeinu Bechaya, one of the great Rishonim, says the following point. He says that walking with God means that it doesn't mean you believe in God, but you see yourself as understanding some of the process. And let me give you an example. We put a lot of emphasis in Judaism on learning Torah. So somebody could be told, okay, it's Sukkos, and this is an esrog. You take it, you shake it around, and your mitzvah. You say, great, now I'm a committed Jew. I'm going to take it, shake it around, mitzvah, done. So that person is doing what they're supposed to do, and they're doing a mitzvah. But is that person really part of it? Or that person somewhat of a outsider following instructions? I mean, there's a big difference between the two. If you don't know what you're doing, if you have no idea what in the world is an esrog, what does it mean? Why am I doing this? What's sukkis? What makes it puzzle? What makes it kosher? So then you're following instructions, which is doing the mitzvah, but you're still somewhat on the outside because I don't really know what I'm doing. Let's say you understand a little bit more about what esrog symbolizes, or what the halachas are, or where it comes from, or why we do it, you know, and you can add some more information into your understanding. Now you're part of the process. You're with it. You're walking with God, versus just doing as you're told by God. So there's a very big distinction between someone walks with God. So Noach is somebody didn't just do what he was told, but he understood more about God in a sense that he felt that he understood the process to some degree. And we strive through when we try to learn and understand mitzvos. What we're doing is we're trying to be more part of the picture. I want to be more intimately connected with God and His mitzvos. And therefore, the more I understand them, the more I can connect. If I don't know what I'm doing or why I'm doing it, even if I do everything right, I'm still, in a certain way, I'm an outsider. I'm an observer, but I'm not part of the picture. And as we all experience, the more we understand a mitzvah, all of us in our lives have probably had this, you know, one time you do a mitzvah, you don't really get it. Then you learn more about it, and you do it again. It feels so much different because now I know a little more what I'm doing. And understand it much more. And that feeling is the feeling of walking with God versus just following God or, you know, listening to the instructions of God. So Noach is described as somebody who wasn't just a bystander in being a tzaddik, but he was really part of the picture, understood a lot, thought a lot, and became part of the process with God. Part of the criticism we have of Noach is that Noach didn't reach out to others. We know Abraham, as soon as he's spoken to by Hashem, it says that he went to Eretz Canaan, and he brought with him a nefesh asher asu b'Charan. He brought with him all the people that he had influenced when he was in Canaan, when he was in Haran. I mean, Abraham was somebody who taught, he reached out to people, he did kiruv, he did outreach, and he was somebody who was able to influence the masses. Noah was somebody who, as righteous as he was, stayed to himself and didn't reach out to others. Which, as we're describing, what's the trait of the Jewish people? Our job is to influence the world, not just to stay to ourselves and do Hashem's bidding, but we're supposed to be that Or L'Goyim, we're supposed to be that light to the nations, which we're supposed to make sure that everyone's influenced by us. So Noach, there is a criticism of Noach. He's somebody who, despite his greatness, did not do a good enough job in reaching out to his generation. So that's why everyone was destroyed besides him. Avram was able to reach out to people. He was able to influence them, bring them into the realm of emunah, of faith in God, and that's one of Abraham's great, you know, great achievements. Additionally, Noach is blamed, very surprisingly. Maybe let's skip to, where is this? It's on page 33. And it's Pasuk 7, Zion. It's a Perek Zion, Pasuk Zion, bottom of page 33. So this is describing when the flood begins. Noach was 600 years old when the flood was water upon the earth. Noach with his sons, his wife, and his sons' wives with him went into the ark because of the waters of the flood. So this is another verse which the rabbis point out a criticism of Noach. Which, again, when you read it, it seems like a pretty neutral verse. I don't see anything wrong with it. But it says, why did he go into the ark? Not because God said so, but because the waters of the flood forced him to go into the ark. Maybe I would contrast for a second. When Avraham is sent to go to Eretz Canaan, it says that Avraham went, Kasher Dibir Lev Hashem, as Hashem spoke to him. Meaning Hashem said, go, I am going. Hashem told Noah, go into the ark, and Noah didn't go until the waters kind of forced him in there. Once, you know, the rain started coming down, and it was up to his ankles or something, he said, okay, I got to go into the ark right now. So the rabbis point out that Noah, in some level, which again, it's hard for us to discuss this, in some level had a lack of emunah on Hashem. He lacked that faith to say that, you know, this flood is coming, and I'm going in because Hashem said so. He had to actually see the flood with his own eyes before he went into the ark. Now that seems to be somewhat of a drastic statement that Noah lacked emunah. I mean, he was a prophet. God spoke to him, and he understood there'd be a flood coming. But the way it's explained is the following. It's something that we could all relate to, you know, at least on our own level. There's a description given by the Stipler Gaon. The Stipler says that there's two levels of emunah one can have. You can have what's called emunah sichlis, intellectual emunah. You understand God in the mind. And emunah chushis, you feel God in your life, in your bones, as it were. So the level of intellectual emunah means that in my head, everything, I understand, I spoke to God, he said there's a flood, it makes sense, God can carry out his word, I believe what he said, that's all intellectual. But sometimes if it's only in the mind, and you don't feel it, there's a feeling of emunah, so you don't act on it so quickly. The metaphor I like to give, I think there's a good analogy we have in regular life. Let's take an example. Let's say any smoker knows that smoking is bad for their health. Ask any smoker. No one's going to tell you smoking is good for me. In this day and age, there's no way. But they're still smoking. Why are they still smoking? Because, you know, even it's bad for me, but, you know, I really enjoy it. It's hard to quit. And even though I'm told by my doctor and my family and my friends that it can kill me, and you know, it gives me all these diseases, and it's going to make me have heart issues, and I can't, you know, I'm not as athletic because of it, and my breath smells, and whatever, anything you're told, I understand it, but it's very hard to quit. Now, let's say that person has a very close friend that dies from lung cancer. They're going to stop smoking pretty quickly after that. Likely they will. Why? Because now you've felt it. It's not just in the intellect, but now you feel it emotionally. It's hit you, you know, at your core rather than just in your mind. So the Stipler says that Noah had emunah, but it's called emunah sichlis. It's only intellectual emunah. Meaning he didn't really feel it. He understood it. And that's what Rashi says, that Noach was, the actual language, Katane Amanahaya. He was small in emunah. He had inferior emunah. Mamin, Veino Mamin. He believed, but he didn't believe. So the Stipler says he believed, meaning intellectually, but he didn't feel it in his bones that it was coming. So once he felt it, meaning he actually felt the water, and the water was coming down, that got him into the ark. But until he had that feeling, he was still sort of like hesitant to go in. Like the Hashem's going to destroy the whole world. Like I'm going to be the only person left. It's quite a drastic move. So he understood it in his mind, but he did not understand it in his gut, as it were. And therefore, it's another criticism of Noah. Versus, I would say Avraham, who is praised for his deep emunah in Hashem. Avraham, we call him the Rosh Chol Ma'amin. He's the first of all the believers. Avraham is somebody, it says V'yamin b'Hashem, that he believes in Hashem. Avraham is the one who we look at as the foundation of emunah in the world. And that's because Avraham's emunah was complete, 100%, head to toe, in his mind, in his heart, in his feelings. It was through and through. And that's how great Avraham was in terms of his emunah. So again, I want to bring out this point to compare Noach to Avraham, that Avraham is somebody who reached out to others, and Avraham is somebody whose emunah was 100%, you know, impenetrable. Whereas Noach's emunah was inferior to some degree, and that's the words of Rashi. I would never say that on my own, but Rashi says it. And Noach, we know, didn't reach out to his generation in the way that he should have, and therefore nobody else was influenced before the flood besides him and his own family. So that's an interesting background to Noach. But nevertheless, he was a great tzaddik. And, you know, we're not the ones that are to judge such a person. Just, you know, we're just quoting from what the rabbis teach us. He's a great tzaddik, and he's somebody that was able to maintain the world, but not able to build Klal Yisrael. And that's an important distinction. He was a great enough person that the world would rest on his shoulders, but he was not yet great enough that Hashem would choose him to be the founder of Klal Yisrael. And that has to be, I think, a perspective on Noach. So let's ask another question. So what happens on the Teva exactly? I mean, so it starts raining, and the flood begins. Noach, all the animals go in, Noach goes in, the door is shut. So they're there for 40 days, 40 nights, it's raining. And the flood is, you know, destroying the world. After that, there was 150 days where it was just water outside, and they couldn't get out of the Teva. They had to wait till everything sort of dried up and seeped into the ground. And so they were still in the Teva past that 150 days before they even were able to get out. So what was happening during the time of the Teva? What exactly did they do every day in the Teva? What was life like there? So the main thing that, I mean, it doesn't describe it that much in the Torah, but it seems pretty self-apparent, and this is the rabbi speak about this. He had to care for the animals. I mean, you have two of every animal in the world, and 14 of kosher animals was what went on to the Teva. So, and they didn't feed themselves. Noach had to take care of them, and feed them, and clean up after them. So it was really 24-7 being a zookeeper. That's what he was doing. He was going to every single animal, making sure they had the proper food. And on the Teva, so we know the Torah says that on the Teva was these animals and their food. So besides having to schlep all the animals on, schlep all the food on. So if you can imagine how much food had to be stored in the Teva, it was also an amazing thing.
And he was wounded a few times.
Yes, and the rabbis say that he was wounded, that he was late giving food to the lion. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It says he's late feeding the lion bit him. That's the animals were not necessarily the kindest and the most appreciative of Noah. I mean, they were still animals or animals. And these weren't magical animals, they were regular animals. And Noah had to be sure that he took care of them properly. You know, lions are full, they don't attack, they say, but when lions hungry, they start getting a little anxious. So so on the Teva, Noah was really involved 24/7 in caring for the animals. What's the message of that? The message is a message of chesed. That if you're building up a new world, we know Olam Chesed Yibane, the world's built on chesed. And Noach was the one to rebuild the world. That world was founded also on chesed. Caring for animals is having to care for other beings. And having to be loyal to feed these animals, make sure that they're cared for, make sure they're clean, make sure they're healthy. That was a 24/7 activity, and that was Noach performing chesed. That's what it was. And when Noach just even slightly messed up, he was bit because his job was to build up a world of chesed. It stands in contrast to the generation before the flood, because they didn't care about one another. They're blamed for sins, that interpersonal relationships were dishonest and corrupt. So Noach had to restart the world with a entire experience of 100% pure giving to other beings. And through that, he trained himself, and he set the foundation for the new world, which is to be a world built again on chesed, just like the first world was built on chesed. Additionally, the Meshech Chachma points out that another thing they were trained for in the Ark, in the Teva, was to what we call hestapkus, being happy with what you have. I mean, they didn't have that much. You know, the resources were limited. How much food can you bring on to the Teva for the humans and the animals that were there? They didn't know how long they would be on the Teva. So they're living on minimal, the bare minimum of what they can live on. There was no luxuries, there was no special extra food. You ate what you were given, and that was it. Live on bare basics. And that was also in contrast to the world prior to the flood. As we said last week, the world before the flood was a world of unbridled prosperity. You know, no limitations. It was food, it was pleasure, it was nice weather, it was 24/7 partying. That was the world before the Teva. They'd only have to farm once in 40 years, and everything would grow. 40 years straight, you'd have crops. The weather was always nice before the flood. It was always, you know, sunny and, you know, 79 degrees outside. It was always a beautiful day, and everyone just had a great time. And, you know, you weren't living on the bare basics. You're living a life of luxury and of decadence. On the Teva, we had to sort of pull that back. We had to say, no, that's not the way a human being needs to live. Human beings have to appreciate what they have. They have to have self-control. They have to moderate. And therefore, they had to live on the Teva an existence of hestapkus, of being able to just be content with what you have and not go beyond that bare minimum. And that's part of the message on the Teva. They were on the Teva ultimately for 12 months. And what happened after, what happened in 12 months? Well, I mean, really, Hashem could have destroyed the world in the snap of his fingers, as it were. I mean, why did Hashem have to bring about this destruction to be a 12-month period? And the answer is very simple, as we said. It was a training period for Noach and for the animals. They needed this 12-month boot camp to restart the world fresh with the right attitude. If they didn't have the time, as we said, to spend time focusing on chesed and spend time living on the bare minimum, they wouldn't have trained themselves to begin the new world. It's only because they had those 12 months. Those 12 months trained them so that they could then emerge from the teva as new people. This applied both to Noach and to the animals. As we said last week, the animals themselves have become corrupt. And the animals also needed a boot camp to change. So for 12 months, the animals are on the teva, and they're also living on bare minimum, and they had to live, you know, in very tight quarters. And that, you know, even though they're animals, that enabled them to come out and be normal animals again, and not to be living the lives they're living before the flood. So the 12-month period is meant to be a training period for Noach, for his family, and for the animals. Now, when they left the teva, they were now new people, and they were new animals. So now they can begin the new world with a new attitude. So we mentioned on the teva was Noach's. He had his Noach and his wife and his sons and their wives. It was two of every non-kosher animal. It was 14 of every kosher animal, and then all the food. That was what was on the teva. It's very well known. The Torah says that there were three levels. Top level was humans. Middle level was animals. Bottom level was all the waste. That was the bottom level, and that was the structure of the teva. The question which the Rishonim ask is, well, how did everything fit? I mean, if you were to do your math for a moment, so the teva, it was pretty big. It was 300 amos long. So let's call that 600 feet as a generous estimate. So we're talking about two football fields long. That's pretty long. It's a pretty massive ship. It was 50 amos wide, so 100 feet wide, and let's call it 60 feet tall. These are using the more generous assumptions of how many feet it is, but let's look at it as big as it possibly could be. So 600 feet long, what did I say, 60 feet tall and 100 feet wide. So I'm not sure to compare it to a modern-day cruise ship. It could be, maybe it's comparable, I don't know. I don't know the dimensions of cruise ships, but it was a very large boat. It was a very large boat. I mean, two football fields is quite large. It's a very large boat. But the Ramban says, even so, if you can imagine having two of every animal in the world on there, they're still not going to fit. And all the food. I mean, it doesn't work out. I mean, just think about, you have two elephants and two rhinos and two hippos. I mean, how much space do you need for that already? And they have to survive. You can't just put them in a little closet and have them die in the table. They have to be able to live. And then you have all the different birds, and you have all, you know, dogs and cats, and go, you know, you think about how many animals there are. And then you have 14 cows on there, and you have, we'll call 14 giraffes, because giraffes are kosher animals, right? So they're 14 giraffes. And then you have 14 buffalo, I mean, because they're kosher. So these are big animals. These aren't small things. So how did it all fit? So, and ultimately, why make a teva at all then? You know, Hashem could have had them, you know, boarded up in some big hotel. I don't know. There could have been other ways they could have saved them without having to build this boat. So the Ramban says 2 points. The Ramban says, number one, the teva is necessary because Noach spent 120 years building the teva. And during that time, everybody who passed by said to him, "Hey, Noach, what are you doing?" He said, "There's a flood coming. If you don't do tshuva, Hashem's going to kill you." And he was supposed to be building that teva so people would see it and take the message. So Hashem wanted Noach to be involved in the process of building some sort of, you know, thing for salvation, so that it would trigger everyone else to ask what's going on here, and he would give them the message of God. It didn't work, but at least Noach tried. So that's why he had to build this thing. But no matter how big he built it, I mean, it wouldn't have fit all this many animals. It was just, it'd be impossible to build such a thing. So Ramban says that it was really a miracle everything fit. Bottom line, the teva existed as a nes. And if there was no nes, then things would not have fit. But Hashem made it that even though it was smaller than it should have been, everything fit inside comfortably. Very similar to what the rabbis teach us about, you know, Yerushalayim. Everyone would go to Yerushalayim for the holidays, for the regalim. And even though technically it would be way too crowded for all the Jews to be there, everyone fit. No one complained, they had no space. Right. No one would say, "Tzar li makom shalim Yerushalayim." There's always space in Yerushalayim. And then they'd go into the Beis HaMikdash, and it'd be time to bow down, and they'll all be standing like this, like a sardine can, and they have to bow down on the floor, and technically shouldn't have fit, and it all fit. Miraculously, everybody's able to bow down, and there's space for everyone to bow down, and it all fit. So we know that Hashem is able to make things fit where they shouldn't fit. We can't figure out in our brains how that works, but that's how it worked. So in the Teva as well, things should not have fit, but they fit nonetheless. So then the Ramban says, okay, if that's the case, then why such a big Teva? What's a miracle anyways? So build a regular size ship, and then everyone will go in, and it'll all fit anyways. If either way it's a miracle, why does it have to be so huge?
Minimizing the...
So make you sweet, is right, because there's an idea of minimizing Nisim. Hashem wants us to do our part. And Hashem always tries to minimize miracles. So he told Noah, you know, this is basically the biggest boat you're going to be able to build. This is humongous. It's not going to fit everything in, but you do your part, and I'll do mine. But Hashem always minimizes Nisim. Hashem wants the world to run naturally. And even things that require an ace, Hashem wants us to minimize that miracle as well, which is an important way to understand how Nisim work in general. So Hashem told Noach, make a teva, it's going to be huge. It's not going to fit everything, but it's still going to be huge, and I'll make sure that everything works out. And that's what happens. They were on this teva for it was 12 months at the end of the day. And even so, you know, it was 40 days of the rain, 150 days till things dried out, till the water started to subside, and then there was another period until it dried up. That was the way it worked. But ultimately, those 12 months, they're living on Nisim. They were, because they couldn't have lived otherwise. But nonetheless, Hashem wants to minimize that Nis. So it was a world of training, those 12 months. They're in their own bubble, being trained for what's going to be like to build a new world. They're learning how to do chesed. They're learning how to live on the minimum and control themselves. And ultimately, Noah was spending his days as a zookeeper. That's how you would view it, taking care of animals. That was his job. When the waters came down, the Teva floated 15 amos above the mountains. So I guess we want to picture maybe Everest or something. So there was enough water to cover Everest, and then 15 amos, like 30 feet above that. So it really covered everything. All life was killed. Even the ground was washed away. A certain amount, I think it says, how many tefachim, 3 tefachim, 10 tefachim, a certain amount of ground washed away as well. And the world essentially was going to be redone after that. The only things that survived were Noah and the animals on the Teva, and all the fish. The fish all survived. What was the merit of the fish to survive? I'm not 100% sure why, but the fish did survive the flood. So I guess sometimes they find these like fish that say these are like really old beings, like prehistoric or something. So maybe it's because they're around since the flood. Who knows? The ones that are at the very bottom of the ocean where no one can go, like they find these like really weird ones that wash up sometimes. Who knows? So 40 days of raining, 150 days the water was still, it wasn't raining anymore, but it was still strong out in the world. And the Ibn Ezra says there's still on and off rain for 150 days. After that, it started really drying up. And they couldn't leave the Teva till 12 months had passed. I want to share maybe one final thought about Noah, and there's always more to share, but we say every Shabbos the pasuk Hashem l'mabul yashav, v'yishav Hashem melech l'olam. Hashem sat at the Mabul, and Hashem sits as the king forever. So it's a very funny pasuk, where Hashem sat at the Mabul, or I'll say through the Mabul, is the king forever. So what's that pasuk trying to emphasize to us? We say this on Friday night. This is putting with the Torah on Shabbos. It's a pasuk we say commonly. So what does it mean? So Rav Hirsch says a very beautiful thought. Rav Hirsch says that let's just imagine for a second how the Mabul, let's say it as it were, impacted Hashem. 1600 years of human history had already occurred. And Hashem, who was the one who was created it all, had a hope for mankind, had to trash it all and start again. Just to put it into human terms for a second, imagine you had worked on, you know, for us, even within a day we have these feelings, but imagine you worked on a project for 6 months. And then 6 months later you realize that something is wrong and you can't finish it. So you feel, I waited 6 months of my life. I put so much work into this, so much time, so much energy, so much effort, and now it's just in the garbage. It's one of the biggest letdowns, because it's a wasted energy. Wasted time to us is so precious. So even though for Hashem you can't really say the same emotions, but at least picture it from our perspective. 1600 years of Hashem's hopes and dreams, kevayachol, as it were, in the world, are totally destroyed. I created Adam and Chava. I expected they're going to carry out a certain mission in this world, and it was a failure. No, and 600 years is a long time for things to fail, and it was a failure. So, from human terms, we would say that most people at that point would be down, depressed, give up. They would have no desire to carry on. They wouldn't see any reason to carry on. You know, I'm a failure. What can I do? You know, I tried and it didn't go. But Hashem Mabul Yosha means, Rav Hirsch says, Hashem sat there at the Mabul with the same exact hopes and dreams for mankind as he had on day one. It never changed. I mean, he said, okay, so most people can't fulfill my mission, but Noach can. And Noach will carry on the mission of mankind. And yeah, everything else has to go, but that's okay because my mission is going to carry on. And I will succeed. And again, we're speaking about Hashem, so of course it'll succeed, but you have to always put it from our perspective, understand you know, how we would react to a situation like that. So Hashem says, don't give up. You know, there's always a way to pick yourself up, carry on, and the goals you have in life, you will be able to fulfill, despite the fact that so much was a failure. We know that in our own lives, if let's say we're trying to work on a certain area, you know, there's something I'm trying to accomplish in my midos, in my service of Hashem, in my service of mitzvos. And I try, you know, when Yom Kippur comes and I make a new commitment. And then a few months down the road, I say it's just not going. So most of us say, okay, I give up. I'm not going to be able to do it. But the Mabul attitude would be, no, I can't give up. I know I saw slight improvements here and there. I see hope. I have a path to do it. I'm going to carry on with my goals, my mission, and it can happen. I'm not going to throw in the towel just because I mostly failed. So Hashem says, I'm not going to throw in the towel. Hashem Mabul Yashiv. Hashem sat there at the Mabul, and he's the king forever. I mean, the same way he was the king before, he's the king after. His same goals for his people that were there before or thereafter, nothing changed at the Mabul. He needed to use Noach instead of other people that were around, because no one else was fit for the job. But Hashem's goal for mankind never changed, never wavered. And we have to have that same attitude, that we also shouldn't waver with from our goals in life. We have goals in life we're trying to achieve. Even though at times, you know, we have setbacks and they feel complicated, they're difficult or complicated to achieve, never, don't give up on it. We need to push forward and make sure that Hashem Yashav, that our goals carry through. So Hashem put his faith into Noach in an amazing way, that you're going to be the one to carry on the mission of mankind, and he was. We look at the people, the goyim referred to as Bnei Noach, as children of Noach, because Noach was the one who stands at top of it all. Jews are Bnei Avraham, we have a different mission, which we'll talk about. But the world carries on the mission of Hashem through Noach, and he's the one who stands as the father of the entire world at this point. So that's who Noach is, that's who he was, and that's, I guess, one perspective on the Mabul. We're short on time, so I'm not going to get into the next topic. We'll probably stop early today. But I want to talk about next week is probably one of the strangest stories you have in the entire Chumash, which is the Dor HaFlaga, the story of the Tower of Babel, the generation of the dispersion, as we call them. And it's basically in the Torah, it's a sum total of, I think, 9 psukim. It tells you very little about who they are and what they do. But Hashem comes in and he seems to punish them and scatter them about the earth. It seems to be a very seminal point in human history, despite the fact we have very little information about it. So I'm going to talk about more of that next week. The one thing I'll share with you now is that, you know, the Rambam very often comes in and he just tries to describe, you see these kind of like random stories in the Chumash, like what's their bigger message? So the Rambam, he doesn't talk necessarily about the particular lesson of the Dor HaFlaga, but he says the following point. He says that anybody who's reading the Torah, if you do your math, you'll have a big question. You'll say, I don't understand. You know, people were only around from the flood until, let's say, Abraham's time. It wasn't that long, 10 generations. But somehow, at a certain point, the whole world populated. People were speaking different languages. People living in different cities. And it doesn't make sense how all that occurred so quickly. I guess from a... even from, let's say, a sociologist standpoint or something, for that to have occurred in so few generations doesn't seem likely. Everyone is gathered together and suddenly the whole world's populated, people are over the place, speaking different languages, doing different things, different cultures. Like, how'd that happen so fast? It takes a long time for cultures to change. You know, you look over a few hundred years of American history, you know, things change, but it takes time. Things take time. So, the Rambam says that the story of the Tower of Babel is here to teach us that it didn't just naturally occur that way, because it couldn't have, because things wouldn't change so fast. Hashem had to intervene and scatter people and change their languages and change their culture for a purpose, which we'll talk about why he did that. But that's how the world became so diverse so quickly. So you talk about diversity. Diversity occurs over spans and spans of generations, but things don't diversify all that quickly. But Hashem came in and he deliberately intervened to disperse and create this diversity, and that's how the world got populated. So the Rambam says, this story is here just so we don't have that question. Because you'll say it makes no sense how the world became so populated so quickly and so different. And the answer is, well, it does make sense, because Hashem took people and he put them in different places and changed the languages. And that's how it occurred. So I guess that'll be our introduction to the story, but we'll talk about that story more in depth next week.